As such, and for a time, they need the services of mental and emotional therapy, which might indeed prepare them for, and make them better able to profit by, the services of philosophy. It is really distressing to find such cases quoted in adverse criticism and harsh comment upon mystical cults, and when the fact is that they entered mysticism already suffering from neuroses, or were made worse by the half-baked methods and ridiculous disequilibrium of those cults. A true mysticism, such as forms a part of philosophy, seeks to maintain its balance and retain its common sense, rationality and practicality, throughout its course. It is much less attractive to the wild neurotics and much more to the sensible or educated people, most of whom are afraid to enter such an apparently doubtful realm of ideas and experiences. There are four distinct functions of the human personality, four separate activities within the human psyche of thinking, feeling, willing and intuiting. These four elements of the psyche must become active at their highest levels, and at the same time kept balanced in their activity. Indeed, the quest's entire work will prove a long course in developing and balancing all the three faculties mostly used, and then making them illumined by, as well as obedient to, the intuitive faculty. When only one or two of these functions of being are active and the others are not, there is a lack of balance. If intellect acts without the guidance, check or control of intuition and emotion, then it will surely mislead itself, make mistakes and come to wrong conclusions. If emotion ignores reason and is unresponsive to intuition, it will surely become the puppet of its egotism and the victim of its desires. If spiritual teaching is brought into the intellect alone or emotions alone, and not into the will, it will be to that extent and in that part sterile. Most aspirants have an unequal development. Some part or other of the psyche is deficient. One may be a very good man, but at the same time a very foolish one. Another may be quite intellectual, but also quite unintuitional. Each enlightenment, as it occurs, is a call to repair this inequality and to aim at wholeness. That few people achieve this harmony of the psyche, that most are ill-assorted unions of adult development in some respects with infantile development in others, is all the more reason why the earnest aspirant should make it his business to examine himself honestly from time to time and use the results in purposeful endeavors to educate himself into wholeness. Each momentary glimpse of the over-self should lead to this end. This need of a developed and balanced personality does not arise only from metaphysical causes, but also from psychological ones. What is the use, for instance, of prescribing meditation to a person who is already too introverted to be able to cope with his personal circumstances? It will only withdraw him still farther from the ability to adjust himself to life and to meet its problems both courageously and adequately, and from the willingness to face its external realities. Such a man is already an escapist, and the practice of meditation will only help to make him even more an escapist than he is. Not by escape into further illusion or a fictitious goal can he find a true path for himself. Philosophy believes in the necessity of integrally developing and harmoniously establishing a reciprocal balance between reason, intuition, emotion and action in the whole human personality. Its aim is not one-sided. It refuses to strengthen character but leave the body weak or to strengthen reason and leave feeling always at variance. The philosophic synthesis brings all these different trends together without interfering with their separate functions. This is done by reconciling them instead of setting them against each other, by recognizing the inevitable manifoldness of all manifested existence. The student seeks to correlate his various tendencies and keep them harmonized, not permitting any single one to become unruly or to usurp the throne of sovereignty. He must use and unite seeming antitheses. When he understands the interdependence of all these different sides of his nature, he relaxes the tension of keeping them in perpetual conflict. No longer is his inner being at cross purposes with itself. No longer is his will self-shattered by its own attractions and repulsions. No longer are his emotions torn and divided by conflicting demands. He does not cling to a pendulum which swings now this way and now that way. He does not sway over to any particular side through ignoring the other sides, does not nourish some qualities by neglecting all the others. He achieves a perfectly balanced character which does not sway too much up or down into intellectual extremes or too far to and fro into emotional moods, and which discriminatingly keeps a proper sense of proportion in all actions. All the different parts of his nature, all the varied faculties of his being, labor unitedly and equilibratedly towards achieving this single end of becoming whole. In this way, he can win gratifying equilibrium from his efforts and actions, even if it comes only with the passage of the years. Philosophy does not alter its integral character, but remains its own self whether it is busy with thoughts or stilling them, whether it is praying on its knees or working in the fields, practicing its preachments. Wholeness and balance are three essentials which it seeks to cultivate, but they are not the only ones. To them has to be added some others which are not less but even more important: re-education of the feelings, prayer, relaxation and meditation. Those who seek by this endeavor to restore their own integrity, remove their own imperfections and attain their own spiritual awareness, are putting themselves into the best possible position to help others do the same for themselves. The response of the higher self to the human call is given under the restrictions of wisdom. It does not pander to our sentimentality nor is it willing to reinforce our egotism. Peace that is worth so much cannot be had without producing its equivalent cost. There will necessarily be a self-denying struggle to transfer allegiance from the senses to the soul, and to make personal habits more aligned to the higher laws. Philosophy is uninterested in flattering a man or in pandering to his vanity. Therefore, it begins the practical side of its discipline by pointing out his defects, faults and shortcomings, and by opening his eyes at last to the weaknesses, incapacities and complexes which hitherto have been unconscious or disguised. To go forward safely on this path, a man needs to be cured of fanatical obsessions and conventional irrationalities. He may think that eradication of personal faults has little to do with finding the true self, but this is not correct. These very faults rise out of the false conception of the I which blocks his path to it, a conception which causes him to identify himself with emotions that he has inherited from animal and primitive human reincarnations. There are followers of mysticism who use it as an escapism, who hope by some magical power to get a transformation of themselves and their lives without having to make any hard effort or to undergo any hard discipline. Three mystical doctrines particularly appeal to them and are constantly taken advantage of to avoid this effort and discipline, this necessary work upon themselves. A fatalistic view of the law of recompense, karma, is taken to justify their stagnation or failure. An infantile view of the relationship with the master is taken to thrust on his shoulders the entire responsibility for their worldly life or problems, and spiritual progress. A too personal view of the doctrine of grace is taken to seek God's favoritism and to support the ego. Too many would-be yogis, whose imagination easily borders on wild fantasy and whose vanity makes them think they are more advanced than they really are, sit like spiders in a web, spinning a tissue of wholly self-centered thoughts and then enveloping themselves completely in it. They fall into hallucinatory experiences and false visions or become the recipients of deceptive messages from imaginary sources, all arising through unwarranted preconceptions, unjustified expectations and egoistic suggestions derived from misapplying their reading of books or their attendance of lectures. They retrograde into careless slovenly habits, becoming less alert and less intelligent, less factual and less useful, less responsible and less practical. They pack their heads with worthless or misleading information got by some psychic or pseudo-intuitive means. The necessity of using caution and feeling responsibility when attempting meditation is thus not to be ignored or forgotten. It can bring many blessings if properly approached and at the proper time, but not otherwise. Therefore, those persons who practice the mystical meditation as a habit, must practice rightly or not at all. Those who do its exercises wrongly or before they are morally prepared or psychologically balanced for it, may receive some benefits but more harm. They devitalize the physical body and disrupt the physical life. It is better to wait until feeling and reason, imagination and discrimination, are brought into healthy equilibrium. All persons are not suited for meditation, and the unsuited ones will always find enough to develop in other directions to make them ready for it eventually. Meanwhile, simple relaxation will be useful. If the divine image is always there within us, the light it sheds and the warmth it emits are often largely or wholly obstructed by intervening walls from reaching our surface consciousness. What are these walls? They are materialistic tendencies, excessive attachments, excessive extroversion, unbalanced nature, violent feelings, evil thoughts, clogged and poisoned bodies, unruled passions, and above all, the unruled ego. Therefore, to become conscious of this light, the aspirant must refine emotions, govern instincts, and thus fortify character. He should start the practice of mystical introspection exercises, begin the study of the metaphysics of truth, and by this self-education acquire a knowledge of the deeper meanings of self and life, the divine and universal laws of human evolution and destiny. He must cultivate the religious feelings and the mystical intuitions by regular effort through prayer and meditation. The purpose of all this arduous purification is to take chains off the feet of the will and the mind and thus give them a chance to move freely into the realm of the over-self. If he is patient and willing to wait, the answer to all questions within the seeker's heart will be found one day, provided he works at this self-purification whilst he is waiting. Regenerating the body, the Sphinx stretched itself out in the desert to warn all candidates for illumination who passed beneath and between its forepaws that they had to overcome their lower nature. They could not leave the outer precincts of the hidden temple and gain entry into its chambers of power until this had been sufficiently done. But the lower nature and lower mind will not relinquish their grip in any other way than by fighting a way out of it. This requires a training of the will, a denial of the appetites, and a discipline of the body which, while not pleasant in the beginning, becomes so in the end. No man has absolute freedom of will and choice in his outward conduct. No man can do just as he pleases. This is as true of the philosopher as of the fool. All men are limited by some circumstance and conditioned by some situation outside themselves. But if there is no real full and perfect freedom of will and choice for any man, no decision of the mind or act of the body for which he alone is wholly responsible, yet two different forms of submission are nevertheless open to him. He is free to be either a servant of his higher self or a slave of his lower nature. Where is the freedom of will for a man who has let himself become enslaved by petty hates, angers and lusts engendered through the body's disorders or toxemias? Men who are not themselves free from these enslaving passions and spiritual unconsciousness, will nevertheless proudly boast of their liberty merely because they have a citizen's rights. To free the will from enslavement to the lower nature leads of itself to enough mental illumination to show the aspirant how false is the freedom which seems to accompany obedience to those passions. It is intolerable to the thinking man that he should let himself be enslaved by appetites that are no longer natural and by passions that are peace-wrecking. No man who aims at a goal superior to himself is likely to avoid failures in will. He may let them pass for a time, but he cannot afford to do so for a long time, for then the habit of inertia or of defeatism may imperceptibly be bred within him and stultify fresh efforts. At a certain point he needs to stop being indulgent towards his frustrations and to start being determined to follow a course of discipline. The smug acceptance of his own shirking of physical and emotional self-discipline is one reason why he fails to make noticeable progress. If he and all those other seekers who complain of making little or no progress would arouse themselves out of their sloth and undertake some real discipline of the body and training of the emotions, they would understand that the first practical step is to do something in the direction of reforming themselves. They would then have less to lament. Moreover, it is often necessary for them to initiate vigorous physical changes if they wish to make their intuitive receptiveness more active and more accurate. Such a discipline must include purification of the body and alteration of its habits along so-called ascetic lines for a time, either as a preliminary or as an accompaniment to whatever mental work is attempted. Without it, the latter loses itself in mere dreaming, or sometimes even delusion. It will be seen that there is a place for asceticism in the philosophic life, but it is a serene and sane place. Instead of being used to hurt or to destroy the body, it is here used to develop and perfect it. Instead of endangering its health, it here promotes the highest state of good health. This work of physical betterment and emotional and passional purification is required most often as a preparation. We need a new view on austerity and penance, a fresh appraisal of asceticism and self-denial. We must inquire why they have held their place in the spiritual life so long and so widely. The mystical ideal has always been historically associated with asceticism. The proper purpose of asceticism has often been misunderstood both by its blind adherents and its superficial critics. It is not a dismissal of the body as illusory by neglect and indifference. It is not a despising of the body as inimical by a slow torture. It is an attempt to put the body in its intended place as a servant of the whole of man's being, including his spiritual being. Although there is much to be said in favor of the rigid disciplines, systems, and routines of most monastic institutions, as devices to detach men from worldly life and to unite them with a holy one, although they may suit the generality of religious-minded aspirants very well, they do not comfortably suit the philosophic-minded. The latter need to grow as the plant and flower grow, with the sun drawing their leaves and petals to spread themselves out. They need a freer air, a less organized and more individual approach. They require fewer rules and easier regulations, less enclosure and less community life. Ascetic disciplines, when intelligently and properly applied, are turned against the senses' domination of the mind so that the latter may be free to turn its attention inward, exploring its own purer recesses. But unfortunately, they have come to mean not only man's denial of the senses by his will, but also his self-tormenting flagellation of them. Philosophy does not give any commendation to an asceticism which seeks to make life as unpleasant as possible under the belief that it is thereby making life as righteous as possible. The direct aim of a regime of philosophic discipline is to prepare the way for spiritual rebirth, to make penance for the sensuality and selfishness of bygone conduct and to prepare the body, the emotions, and the mind for the influx of higher forces and holier currents. Its indirect aim is to get rid of disease and give health and vigor to the body. It ought to be recognized that the so-called normal state of civilized man is really unnatural and unhealthy, that the re-education of the mind and training of the body which the quest brings about are really therapeutic processes, and that this attempt to achieve harmony with the over-self is really a healing effort. Whoever violates the hygienic laws of his body and being is eventually asked by nature to suffer the consequences. He who remains uninterested in human life and indifferent to the human body, naturally makes no attempt to understand the world of which the body is a part, and which he regards either as evil or as illusory. Consequently, he has no revelation or insight which will explain their nature, laws and evolutionary developments. The problem of how to live peacefully in the body and cope with its diseases and passions, is not solved by declaiming the illusoriness of its character. The student who is seeking this higher knowledge will not only not be able to assimilate it beyond his personal capacity, but also will not be able to make more of it than his shortcomings allow. For instance, his unbalance or his insensitivity, his bodily bad habits or unruly emotional conditions will enter into what he learns and deform it. Some degree of mental-emotional self-correction and physical purification is usually laid down as a prerequisite before it can be fully imparted to him. This work upon himself calls for a certain amount of severity towards himself. Therefore, disciplinary practices are quite rightly a part of the earlier stages of the mystical method. Philosophy itself incorporates and does not object to them. It objects only to the exaggerated importance laid upon them, and to the pursuit of them into ascetic extremes. Typical instances of exaggerated and unreasonable asceticism which it utterly rejects are, the curé's refusal to smell a rose, so inflicting horrible tortures on his body with iron instruments, hair shirts and even sharp nails, the Mohammedan fakir dwelling, eating and sleeping among the gravestones of a cemetery, Madame Guyon putting sharp flints and pebbles inside her shoes when about to go for a walk. It is the hardest of struggles for the aspirant to overcome his passions, rule his desires and control his thoughts. Buddha said that the man who conquered himself was greater than the conqueror of cities. The effort involved is indeed so great that it must necessarily extend over many, many reincarnations. There are some practical ways in which the aspirant can make the struggle shorter, the triumph easier. The first purification to which he is called is that of the body. The practice of this ancient technique unveils the true instincts of the body, and to some extent even of the feelings, instincts which have been deeply buried beneath the conventional materialism of society, civilization, and tradition. It serves a threefold purpose: penance, purification, and healing. The reduction, or even elimination, of gluttony at the dining table, of meat eating, alcohol drinking, and tobacco smoking, are signs of such advance. Gluttony is a mistake in bodily hygiene more than a sin in moral conduct. It consists either in taking into the mouth food and drink in excess of the body's actual needs to maintain health and strength, or in taking such articles of diet as are harmful to it. Such a violation of its laws must inevitably lead, with the efflux of time by cumulative effects, to a disturbance of its proper functioning or a manifestation of disease. The accumulation of this unwanted or discordant material ultimately affects health, nerves, emotions, and mind in an obstructive or debasing way. One effective way of reducing this accumulation is fasting, done occasionally and for short periods only. It is not at all necessary for man to deprive any living creature of its body in order to sustain his own flesh. Nature has provided him with all he needs in grains, vegetables, fruits, and dairy products. As late as the 4th century, when Saint John Chrysostom was writing, he says that we, the Christian leaders, practice abstinence from the flesh of animals to subdue our bodies. The unnatural eating of flesh meat is of demoniacal origin. The eating of flesh is polluting. Let us remember that the writer of this argument for vegetarianism was, in the opinion of Saint Augustine, the most authentic and eloquent Christian literary advocate of his time. The so-called normal man fills his body with toxic waste products by wrong eating and lack of inside cleansing. These in turn fill him with morbid appetites and continuous desires. The really normal man will thoroughly enjoy his meals, yet will never eat for the sake of eating, taking no more food than is needed by the body to sustain its functions. He may enter into the sex relation, but he will not enter it solely at the body's unrestricted bidding, nor only under the impulsion of inflamed senses, nor merely at the suggestion of another person who is the victim of such bidding and senses. He will not allow the precious distillation of his vital essence to be wasted continually in weakening self-indulgence, nor the precious freedom of his heart and mind to be surrendered to sexual slavery. He will not let himself be blinded by the physical ecstasy produced by sexual intercourse to the metaphysical reflection that it is only a brief, pitiful, and shifting counterfeit of the ecstasy produced by spiritual elevation. Brief or because in a few minutes it is gone. Pitifuller because its cost is so often so disproportionate to its value. Shiftinger because those in whom it originates may come to tire, dislike, or even hate one another. It is more immediate and perhaps more enthralling than the ecstasies produced by artistic and intellectual creation or appreciation, but they are less costly and more lasting. Nevertheless, sex energy is a low, limited form of the world mind's creative energy. The joy it yields is a muffled echo whose original sound belongs to a divine region. This is why it is so sought after. The aspirant should not let the morbid, the negative, and the toxic come into his body or his mind. The purpose of ascetic regimes is multifold, but its primary ones are to purify the body and the emotions and to restore them to true health. He who voluntarily reforms his habits of living, introducing certain stretching, tensing, pressing and breathing exercises, changing the day's routine and diet at the bidding of principle and in defiance of appetite, gains physical fitness and strengthens moral force as a higher result. It is necessary to cleanse the body of its impurities and cure it of its malfunctionings to some extent, along with emotional and mental cleansing, so that the personality may open up to the forces of the over-self without further obstruction than that which is always present and always the most formidable of all, the ego. Some purification must precede and make possible regeneration. The failure to understand this may be one reason why those who practice meditation but neglect balance and purification often fail to make the expected progress towards glimpses of the over-self. Only out of the growth of his experience and the ripeness of his understanding will man come to question his desire nature, and to limit it in the interests of the quest. For only then will he perceive that it is no longer enough to evaluate things from the point of view of their pleasurableness or painfulness alone. By the growth which time and experience, reflection and reason bring to him, he begins to empty his heart of the gluttonous appetites and morbid desires which the body's toxicity creates for him. In the reform, uplift and perfection of his moral and emotional life, he may take advantage of certain physical aids which could make his endeavor markedly easier. This re-education of the body's instincts and appetites, passions and nerves, is helped by the use of pressures, tensions, abstentions, cleansings and even violence constructively directed against them. It is quickest done by an arousal of the will as an act of sacred devotion, by the determined and regular practice of creative psychophysical exercises which channel the force behind them into health, virtue and mastery. From this purifying of the fleshly body, as a part of the total effort to open a way for the entry of the intuitive element, it will be an easier passage to the purifying of the feeling nature. To find inward tranquility and outward health of the body is to lay the firmest foundation for whatever other happiness life may bring. Re-educating the emotions. In the past, the seeker's emotional life was largely an instinctive response to the senses, a blind process in which he was often carried away to his own harm. There was no real freedom of will in it, only an imaginary one. But now some light falls upon the whole scene. Henceforth, the emotions are to be freed from their enslavement to the senses, are to be guided to move for his best interests by his own higher will, are to be ennobled, refined and spiritualized. The petulant childish person who is adolescent in emotional attitude must develop into a more mature, balanced and self-disciplined adult before the mystical exercises can be profitably pursued. The neurotic whose emotions are still at an infantile level, who gives way to panic and tantrums, who storms into hysterics at the slightest provocation, should realize that his immediate task is not to develop mystical powers, but rather to develop moral virtues. The over-self will refuse him a glimpse of itself until he does develop them. It is more important for him to build up character than to sit down and meditate in quest of psychic sensations. Otherwise, it is all too easy for the ego to surround him with an emotional mirage, formed of so-called love, hate, sentimentality, fear, bliss or whatever else suits its purpose at the time, and thus impede his progress or throw him back. He who nurses a grievance, for instance, who cultivates a sense of being injured and feels resentment against the person he deems responsible for it, interrupts his own spiritual progress. He cannot manage the trying situation without yielding to its provocation, expressing his lower emotions or displaying his unworthy attributes. He blames the lack of spiritual development in others for this result when he should blame himself. This evasion of responsibility is an old trick of the ego, but nobody is more responsible for its fortunes and misfortunes than itself. The ego masks itself so thoroughly and so speciously that he is unaware of how it is harming him. Let him not make the mistake of hiding his faults from himself. It is negative emotions like meanness, dread, malevolence, enmity, malice, intolerance, bigotry, sulkiness and quarrelsomeness which make up the ego's strength when it stubbornly refuses to yield to the over-self's silent voice. This foolishness of bolstering up the ego instead of acknowledging its guilt, puts unnecessary obstacles in his way and keeps the soul's grace at a distance. His judgments will be wrong. His goals will turn out to be phantoms and his life will be haunted by misfortunes when he insists on defending the ego instead of censuring it. He will do better to transfer the object of resentment to his own ego for the lifelong deception it has played on him and for the lifelong injury it has done him. The more it makes itself conscious of its faults, the more it may expect from life. The quicker it recognizes its blunders, the better its future will compare with its past. The less it is anxious to improve its neighbors and the more to improve itself, the greater the likelihood of doing both.